Hey everyone, welcome to My Two Cents with Tawanda Harris. This is a podcast dedicated to educators, for educators, and by educators. Yes, it's all about encouraging, it's all about sharing strategies, it's all about going on an educational journey with each other. You are not alone, and I hope that when you finish listening to this podcast, you feel like you went on a journey with educators around the world. Thank you for tuning in to My Two Cents. In this episode, I had the opportunity to sit down with Miss Julia Torres, an educator out of Colorado. We talked about ways to create spaces for students to see themselves again in our classroom and why that is so important. Paulo Freire often has said, students become the teacher and the teacher becomes the student. Listen in as we talk about ways that the balance of power in our classrooms need to be shared differently. Can you start off by just kind of sharing, telling the listeners a little bit about who you are, and then sharing with us your teacher journey?
Sure. So my name is Julia Torres, and I am a librarian and language arts teacher in Denver, Colorado. My journey to becoming a teacher really probably began before birth, because both my parents were teachers. My grandmother was a teacher. I come from a long line of people who have been involved.
It was inevitable.
Yeah, it was inevitable. My grandfather was in charge of the social work programs in Ohio, and he was the one who pioneered the licensure for social workers in the state of Ohio back in, I want to say, the mid to late 50s. So anyway, I want to just always give credit to my ancestors and forebears, because they are a large part of the reason why I'm here. When I was very young, I used to go to Bermuda to visit my grandmother, and she lived there, and she would often give me lessons in art and just whatever she felt like teaching me, because she was a jack of all trades.
Of course, and that's grandmothers.
Yeah. So I would visit her. I was very blessed to have a grandmother living in such a beautiful place. And, you know, one might call it privileged, spoiled to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. But it was important to my family that I not lose touch with her, even though I lived in California. And I did live in Texas at some times when I was very young. And they'd fly me out. My family would fly me out to go and spend time with her. So my grandmother was one of my earliest teachers. And when it came time for me to choose a profession, I wanted to do something that came easily to me, that came naturally to me. So I got a bachelor's degree in English, just because I thought, okay, this will be easy for me. Let me go ahead and do something that I can then hone, not something that I have to learn from scratch. And to be honest, you know, I originally thought I was going to be a marine biologist, and then I realized how much math and science there was, and I couldn't do it.
That's a big contrast.
Right? Yeah. I've always loved the sea. So, you know, I did originally want to be a marine biologist, and then saw how much STEM was required, and it just wasn't ever something that came easily to me. So changed my major to English, and became an English major, and finished my bachelor's in 3 years, after which my daughter was born. She was actually pregnant when I graduated from college. So, or I was actually pregnant with her when I graduated from college. So that was, a really interesting experience to go there.
The joy of walking across the stage with her.
Mm-hmm. Well, she was in my belly.
Yeah,
she did travel. She traveled
with you.
Yep. Yeah. So that happened, and then I worked at a school, at a high school, as a college and career counselor for a bit. And I got to work with kids, and I just felt like that was really something that I loved. And I had kind of a scary pregnancy, because my daughter was born premature, 2.5 months premature.
Oh, wow.
So I wound up staying home, quitting my job as a college and career counselor, and staying home and taking care of her for a year, the first year of her life. And then when I decided to go back to work, I wanted to do something, but I just didn't know what. So I became a para, and I was a para in the schools, which gave me just enough exposure to see how school systems work. Okay. And at that time I was in Park City, Utah. And in order to become a teacher, you needed to get into the sub system and start subbing. So people had to trust you and they had to know that you were going to do what you were told, basically.
Wow. So, that's the criteria.
Right. It's very different from now, where you can go through an alternative licensure program 2 or 3 weeks in the summer and get a teaching job right away.
No teaching experience at all.
Yes, things have changed. Things have definitely changed. So my first teaching post, I was teaching, doing my student teaching and my first teaching job concurrently. So I actually got paid for doing student teaching, which is rare.
That's good.
Right. I needed it because I was really a mom. Uh-huh. You know, I needed to take care of my baby.
Uh-huh.
So it was a really interesting situation because I was teaching 7th and 8th graders and I was being observed a lot by people and frequently found not to be the best teacher. The learning curve is pretty steep with teaching anyway, but in that particular teaching post, it was pretty steep. I remember one time I left the room, rookie mistake, left the room to go and get some copies. And the copy machine was just down the hall. Came back into the room. The kids had lined up the desks. They were standing on them and falling off into each other's arms.
Oh my God. Doing trust
falls. Yes. Yes. So that was wild.
Wow.
So I taught middle school for 1 year and then went directly to high school. And I felt like high school and the older kids was just my calling. So was teaching at Park City High School in Park City, Utah for a while. And what was interesting about that post is that at that time I was 26 years old. So I really wasn't that far removed from the kids.
Uh-huh.
So it was very interesting. The lessons that I learned about.
How did they treat you? Was it like more friend-like?
Yes, but I was also the only Black teacher probably in the state at that time.
Oh, wow.
So it was very odd. And I can say there were great moments and I'm still close with a few of my students from that time. But there were also moments where they actually taught me really valuable lessons about what we call classroom management. The truth of the matter being, you don't have control over anyone. Any control that you might believe you have over individuals is an illusion. And it is only that they give you power because of a variety of things. They either really like you, they believe in you. They feel like the consequences for not listening to you will be worse than the consequences for listening to you. You know, but overall, I think that a lot of the struggle that I faced was just due to inexperience, you know? So I was taught a lot of lessons by those kids. And I can say as far as years that have taught me the most, that would probably be maybe number two in, you know, of the top 3 years that taught me the most. So I've
like the lesson that you just said that you learned from your students, unfortunately, everyone hasn't arrived to that understanding that students, you have control over your students because they allow you to have, you know, for lack of a better term, control, but they, you know, they see that you love them, that you care for them, that they trust you and all of those things. That is important because it goes back to just the relationship building piece.
Right.
So you have a student that can be compliant. I will do what you ask me to do, but when I leave from your presence, I will resort back to who I am. Versus that student agency that you can build in your classroom where this is who I am. I'm comfortable with being me in your presence, as well as I walk out of your door, I am who I am and you bring value to that.
Right, right. And I think that in the best scenario, you would have a classroom environment where students, sometimes the teacher is the student and the student is the teacher, as Paulo Freire has often said, those are our best moments, and when we realize that the balance of power needs to be shared differently. And I think that's what I really learned from that experience and others. Mm-hmm. That any power that I believed myself to have in a classroom setting was there because somebody else gave it to me. Yeah. So moving on, I went to suburbia in Colorado and I taught at a high school where everybody was required to teach a lower grade and upper grade. So you either taught 9 and 11 or 10 and 12 or 10 and 11, something like that, some combination, so that there was accountability. And I really liked that because then nobody could get into this elitist idea that they are the upper class high school teacher, you know, and they have ownership over all of the cool activities and the complex conversations. I liked it when it was divided up and every teacher had responsibility for lower grades and upper grades. Mm-hmm. So I learned quite a bit from that experience, but I think the biggest lesson was that it taught me to step into my personal power, because once again, I was in a situation where there were no other Black women anywhere around me at all. Mm-hmm. And there were really no folks who strongly identified with ethnic or cultural or racial groups. So, you know, if there were people of color, the majority of them had assimilated because they did so to protect feelings of, you know, whatever power that they believed they had. I don't know. I can't speak for them. I don't know exactly why they might have wanted to assimilate, but we know the struggle for people of color in who are minoritized in educational spaces. It often requires a degree of assimilation or, you know, I would say making our cultural and ethnic identities smaller, which is just such an awful thing now that I'm hearing myself say it. Yeah. But that is the reality for a lot of us who find ourselves being one of none or one of, you know, a very small percentage of people in the district or building who identify as people of the global majority, as Montessori for Social
and
Justice.
Also just thinking being of you being new to education, being in a space, I first need to be comfortable with being a new teacher. You know, I have to figure out, you know, where my strengths are or where my areas of growth are as I reflect through the school year, let alone me being the only person of color in that space. Now it becomes, you know, who can relate to my issue of teaching students as a person of color, because there's a difference. Yes. I've taught most of my years in schools that were Title I schools, where the poverty rate was, you know, 98% or higher. And just being able to adjust in that setting was not hard for me because that was kind of the environment I grew up in. But I transitioned to a role in which I supported schools that were at a higher socioeconomic status. And it was hard for me as one Black woman going into the schools to give advice or to help to support the learning when no one looked like me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I would agree.
Yeah, that is a challenge. What were the demographics of the school, the school that you were just speaking about?
One was majority white students and teachers. Okay. I think the total percentage of students of color or students who identify as people of color, I'm trying to move away from using students of color, but the percentage would probably have been less than 15% of the total school population combined.
Wow.
So that's all groups combined. Wow. And so I eventually left just because the feeling of otherness was getting so ridiculous that I just didn't feel like I could be productive or happy as a human being in that setting. So, and there were, you know, various incidences where I felt dehumanized and disrespected. And, you know, anytime a Black woman encounters a scenario or situation with folks where, you know, I know that sometimes I come off as being really confident, but I have my insecurities just like anyone else. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes folks will perceive me to be this person who has this huge ego and needs to be brought down to size. Mm-hmm. And I just think that attitude is so indicative of the misogyny that exists within education.
Definitely.
But then also, you know, the real disrespect that Black women get in a lot of spaces. People have no idea the fights and the battles that we have to go through to become the grown women that we are.
Yes.
And so it's tremendously unfair to assume that anybody needs to be brought down to size, you know?
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree. I it makes me think about the work of Bettina Love and so many others around just adultification mm-hmm. of young Black women. And I have a young daughter, and that within itself, you know, just kind of bothers me when she has to kind of be quiet in certain spaces because her voice can be very intimidating because her personality is so large. And yep. So here we are as moms saying, be yourself, you know, walk into a room and be comfortable in your skin and all of those things that we want our young girls, our young Black girls to do, but then they go into spaces in which they're asked to be quiet.
Right.
Don't do this. And then if you don't, then you're being disrespectful, or, you know, you're not being obedient and all of these things. And so I know that she has to struggle through those things of when do I speak up and when do I not speak up?
And so interesting too, though, because hearing you say that, the messaging right now is yes, be yourself, Black girl magic, take up space, we love you, Black women shine. And then the other side of the coin, on the other hand, you have so many people saying you're arrogant, be quiet, uh-huh. you know, I'm gonna silence you or co-opt your ideas. Yeah. That happens frequently.
Yeah. Definitely. You know?
So it's really disturbing, the messaging that I think the lack of self-reflection there from individuals and systems and society on the whole, with regard to how they perpetuate systems of oppression that keep Black women feeling like we need to be small. That's mm-hmm. that's really problematic for me. So in a nutshell, that's why I left that second position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you were to ask any of my coworkers, they would say, what? I'm shocked. She felt that way, which uh-huh. is indicative of the fact that I never felt strong enough to voice how I felt.
Uh-huh.
I never yeah. felt free to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Or just the emotional trauma that comes along with speaking up. You know, oftentimes we have to go back into the very space that we have spoken up against. Yep. And just emotionally, it's like, until I find something else, I'll just be quiet just so that I can handle this in a way that I can practice self-care for my sanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that that was very much how I felt. I needed to keep the peace by being quiet as long as possible. And I also lacked the confidence and the conversational skills to be able to stand up to people when I felt like I was wronged. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, something that I have always endeavored to teach my daughter, is how to stand up for herself when she feels like she's not being treated well. And, you know, the next environment that I went into was the one that I'm still in. And I stay because my community values me. One of my principals just told me earlier this week, we're lucky to have you, you know, and just voicing those things, when somebody mm-hmm. just voices that, it goes a long way toward making somebody feel like their contributions matter. Mm-hmm. I've never felt like a worse teacher than I do now, other than mm-hmm. probably in year one or two of teaching. You know, yeah. the struggle is very real right now. But I feel mm-hmm. like my community has my back. I know that there are a lot of people in my community who hold it down when I need them to, because they know that I'm going to do the same when they need me. And I'm mm-hmm. very blessed to be able to co-teach with a lot of really talented people. And, you know, obviously we're not perfect. We have our issues. They're closing 4 of my 5 schools in 2022. So there's a lot of uncertainty right now. But one thing I am certain of is that I've never felt more valued or respected as a professional than I do now in the community where wow. I'm serving.
That's awesome. And, you know, just think about that feeling you have as an adult, how that is needed for you as an adult. And so often our students don't get to experience that. And they're kind of forced to, you know, because they don't have a choice to leave the classroom, they have to endure a full school year in which they may not feel valued. And right. Hopefully the next year they may experience that feeling of value. And if they don't, they have to endure another school year. I think about my son, my son, we took him out of an older, his previous school because that very thing was happening. We had a child that loved to learn. I mean, would score in the highest percentile on standardized tests without even studying. I mean, he just loved to just get more knowledge. But what we noticed is in this environment, there was a decline in his excitement to learn, his excitement to just go to school, as well as his feeling of being valued in that space. Mm-hmm. And I think the challenging part for us as parents is we knew that this was a space, you can't see my air quotes, that was supposed to be a great education. And mm-hmm. so we put him in there in which he was the minority, but he was not being valued. And so as soon as we finally said, you know what, it's not worth it, and we pulled him out and we put him in a space in which he was valued, we saw the light bulb just start to come back on. And, you know, I mean, I would tell the story and get tears in my eyes, because as a parent, who wants to see this happen to their child? And you're trying to figure out what can you do to make it better? But I think of our students that don't get sometimes that light coming back on experience that some of our children do get.
Yes. Yeah, I think in an ideal world, if we're able to change things the way that we would envision them, instead of always having this, you know, and then, and next, and tomorrow, and things will be better, instead of always having that at the forefront, I think that we've got to look at where we are right now. And some really phenomenal educators, Goldie Muhammad, Dr. April Baker Bell, Luz Yadira, and Carla España, they have written books about empowering folks from marginalized backgrounds yes. to be able to step into the educational, sorry, it's Luz Yadira Herrera. I forgot her second last name, but I wanna make sure that I'm respecting the work that they've done, because they're mm-hmm. folks in the academic spaces mm-hmm. who are writing really important work about how teachers can move toward a more liberatory practice mm-hmm. and one that doesn't produce students who feel like their voice doesn't matter, no one wants to hear, nothing that they could say would actually make a difference anyway.
Yes, I agree. I definitely agree. One of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is I was listening to your conversation around with Jacqueline Woodson, author Jacqueline Woodson. And it was such a great, well, first off, the entire thing was wonderful. But the pieces that were like golden nuggets that stuck out to me, one was your talk around students seeing themselves as authors. Mm. Think of where we are right now and what I've seen over the past couple of years, especially in Georgia or states that have changed the way they assess writing, mm-hmm. that shift in what writing instruction looks like. And so we know that there are, unfortunately, spaces that still teach to a test. When writing came off the table of assessing the process of writing or assessing students' thoughts outside of text, mm-hmm. and the way we taught writing completely shifted. And so we have schools that don't teach writing unless a piece of text is present, or only teach constructed writing responses and not writing as a way of reflecting and just, you know, creating stories using your imagination. So the part that just really stuck out to me, as I said, is, you know, students seeing themselves as authors. So my question is, how can classrooms create this space to happen again? How can we revive that?
You know, I think that one of the things that we can do is think back to just 10 years ago. So that would take us to 2010. At that time, we were still free to do quite a bit creatively in the classroom. Mm-hmm. I was able to teach about kanji scrolls when I was doing a world mythology unit. Mm-hmm. And I had students creating these beautiful works of art and researching kanji and trying to understand how they could make sentences and bringing in wood blocks that told stories about, you know, Eastern, not only mythology, but history as well. It's so difficult to be creative like that in a lot of spaces. And I think that administrators and school leaders need to be really reflective about the types of schools that they want to have, because those that are in more privileged spaces, I think the assumption is that they have more freedom to, you know, allow students choice and artistic expression and things like that. But sometimes the parents have really narrow expectations of what students will learn in those spaces. So it's not uniformly true that they will, or universally true, that they have more freedom if their parents are paying tuition. Mm-hmm. So folks need to really look at the oppressive and restrictive systems that exist within their educational, you know, ecosystem. So what are the procedures and systems that we have within our school, but then also within our district, then also within our state, then also within our region? What are the expectations that community members might have for a student's education that really have nothing to do with what the students themselves want to learn or feel empowered by giving the freedom to learn? And then I think also we need to be really honest with ourselves about the corporate or capitalist influence on education, because whether you're in a private or an independent school environment or a public one, there is typically some kind of money being funneled into the school because money makes things move. Mm-hmm. And often the folks who have the money have their own agendas about how the school should be run because they have that financial investment. Mm-hmm. And so we need to figure out healthier ways of collaborating, being transparent, communicating, rather than manipulating data in order to get money. Because mm-hmm. a lot of times that's what happens. And so then what do? Manipulate or put pressure on teachers to give the data so that the data will look a certain way so that they can get that money.
Yes.
You know?
I agree. I was thinking as you were talking about this whole idea of creating spaces for these things to happen. And so it goes back to what our values and our beliefs are as school leaders or as schools. If I believe a certain thing, if I'm thinking about, you know, my mission or my vision for my organization, then my schedule should reflect that very thing.
Yeah.
My the extracurricular opportunities that I want my students to engage in, it should go back to what I believe and what I value in my organization about my students, you know, where those values are. And so often our beliefs and our values mismatch with what we're offering to students.
Absolutely.
And you know, the danger in that is we say, yes, I think that, you know, students, we want to give them a better chance at life. We want them to think critically. We want them to be change agents and all of that. But our curriculum does not allow for that very thing to happen. So when we say, hey, we want to create, you know, help students to see themselves as authors. Well, what space am I allowing that to happen? Mm-hmm. And what needs to change in my day-to-day instruction, or what partners or who in the community can come in to mentor and, you know, motivate those that maybe just need, you know, to be exposed or access to that.
Well, and here's the thing. Here's a reflective piece too. Back in 2010, 10 years ago, it wasn't uncommon to have journalism everywhere, to have civics education everywhere. civics mm-hmm. education and journalism have been systematically removed from a lot of places.
Yes.
So yes. What does that tell you? You don't want the students to speak because you know that you're oppressing them. So you don't want them to tell the truth about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then civics education, you take away their information about how the system can be changed, or you only let a select few have that information, those in independent schools or those in the wealthier upper middle class suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're gatekeeping the information about how the system can change, and then you're silencing people. And effectively, that's what happens. Mm-hmm. But they will say, well, we just don't have money for a journalism teacher, or we just don't have money for another civics teacher. We don't have an extra FTE or whatever it is that they'll, you know, the excuse that they'll give. But these are things that will have long decisions that will have long reaching consequences.
Yeah.
And I thank you so much for the conversation that you pointed out with Jackie Woodson. I love talking to her. And I think that one of the most fundamentally important things that she said that I heard was that Hemingway taught her about economy of language and how useful that can be. Because I admire her as a writer and as a human being very, very much. And I think that when it comes down to economy of language, that's something that all of us can benefit from, being a little bit more judicious about the words that we use when we communicate, you know?
I agree. And, you know, it's very much, you know, it's important that we as the adults in the space model what that looks like, and right. not, you know, place ourselves higher than our students, but help them to understand that the learning, I heard Dr. Goldie Muhammad say, it's two-way. The learning is two-way. If you walk into a space and you are distributing information and you don't change because of the information that you just gave, then it was one way. And what mm-hmm. value is that? When you're teaching a lesson, you should gain some learning from that as well. So I'm learning from my students as well as my students are learning from me, and it becomes two-way and very collaborative in nature.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that that's possible in a variety of environments, but I would hope that 10 years from now, we're not still hoping for more liberatory environments, but that the norm has become that students are in an environment that supports their creativity and their creative expression, as well as the curiosity that is within every child. At least I believe that.
Yes. You know? I wholeheartedly believe that that is something that is crucial, and that we have to think about, you know, 10 years from now, what behaviors or things that we're putting in place or that are shifting, how will that appear in 10 years? Will we go right back to business as usual once we're able to go back to a traditional space with the brick and mortar 5 days a week without masks? Will education go back to the same way? And the hope is no, yeah. Absolutely not, because it was not working for all of our students, and that student agency was not happening. You know, students weren't allowed to speak. As you said, some were being silenced.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's definitely something to think about.
Mm-hmm. It really is. And I think as I grow more into my librarian self, I can only have responsibility for so much. Right now, my job and my responsibility is to get everybody in Montbello reading and help them love books. That's my job. So I'm focused on that. The things that I do outside of the district, I've been really blessed to be able to have folks look to me as a leader in education, which that's very surprising to me, given the fact that just a few years ago, people were very disrespectful to me in the early years of my career, very, and they never would have put me in a position of leadership, you wow. know? And so the fact that folks would look to my leadership now, I take that as a tremendous responsibility to make mm-hmm. sure that the things that I'm sharing with them and teaching are quality, and they're going to, you know, push them to think differently about the role that they have in education, but also in children's lives. But my primary responsibility is to my community and to my kids here in my house, you know? So I never forget that. And if it all went away and all of a sudden folks said, you know, Julia hasn't published a book by, you know, these four educational publishers, and it doesn't look like she's going to, so we're all going to move on and jump on the bandwagon of the next person who we want to follow. I would just hope that they would know that the number one most important thing to me is that I'm always showing up with authenticity for my community and for my students.
That's good. Yeah.
And that if I fall off, I have developed a crowd of people around me who will help bring me back to myself. Mm-hmm. And that's what I hope for folks out there who are listening. You know, yeah. I hope that you will surround yourself by people who will remind you of why you became an educator in the first place. And I hope that you will remember that your first responsibility is to your community and to the students in your school.
Yes. So you have given a whole lot. You know, this is the type of podcast, this is the episode that you'll need to listen to several times over to grab all of the nuggets that you have just dropped in here. So I thank you so much for, you know, just what you do, you know. Oftentimes we look at someone's the way that they started in education and say, okay, well, this is, you know, you have a limited impact on what, where you can go or how you can shape education. And that you have just proven that definitely that is not the case. And that because of your experience, this is why you are who you are. But, you know, can't we go on and on about how we started a thing and there were other plans for our life to make a greater impact, even a greater impact that we even thought we didn't think could happen.
Yes.
But what a blessing it is that you are able to do the things that you do. So I thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much for, you know, amplifying my voice. I really appreciate it. And you know, I'm very grateful to you and others in our community who are just doing everything that they can to make sure that school is a better experience for our most marginalized and disenfranchised individuals in the system. That's definitely a common goal that we share.
Yes. Well, before we get out of here, I want to ask you some rapid fire questions, some really fun questions, so listeners can kind of get to know you a little bit better, just very quick questions. So are you ready?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
what was your favorite book to read as a child?
That's a tough one. I would say that I really enjoyed so many different books, but the first ones that come to mind right now are Piers Anthony wrote a lot of those episodic series books where he would tell, like, the Dragons of Pern was this story about this faraway planet with these dragons and this like stuff that would come down from the sky, and it was kind of like acid rain, and it was kind of strange type of story, I guess, if you're not a fantasy sci-fi fanatic like I am. But I really liked The Dragons of Pern and anything Piers Anthony. So we'll go with that.
Today. If I ask you tomorrow, it might change. Okay.
And they're different phases, right? Like, it was Bread and Jam for Francis when I was a small child. Mm-hmm. And then, or The Church Mice Spread Their Wings. And then, you know, when I got to junior high, it was The Dragons of Pern. And then when I got into high school, it was historical fiction. I couldn't get enough of that. So, you know, it changed a lot over time.
Yeah. And it should. It definitely should, based on your mood. Okay, so who sparked your love for reading? I think I know. Okay.
Well, my mom, because she's a librarian. So there were books in my home from the very beginning. So I have to give her full credit for that. My mother.
Awesome. Okay, your mother. All right. And what is your where is your favorite place to curl up with a good book?
In my bed. I'm not going to lie. I went and spent the money and got myself a Sleep Number at the beginning of this year. And I have zero regrets, because this has been the year that you really need to be able to get a good night's sleep. And the Sleep Number, if you ask me, is worth every penny.
Oh my goodness. That's good to know. I'm taking notes on that. That's something I need. Okay, so thank you so much for answering those quick questions so folks can get to know you a little bit more. Are there any tips that you would give to any educator out there that's listening?
Just what I mentioned earlier, just remember, you know, no matter how small you might feel your contributions are, you just never know how you might change somebody's life in one lesson one day, and that will have a ripple effect that will change the lives of many. So, you know, that's for those who are feeling like they're really small. And for folks who have been amplified, you know, for a moment, for a season, for a day, for a year, just know that it's important too to nurture those bonds within your community, the people who are actually in your real life every day. We live in this time, this tricky and confusing time of edu celebs, where people feel like they need to aspire to something greater all the time. And the work that we do in our own communities and schools with the people who are around us, that's still the most important.
I agree. All right. So where can folks find you on social media?
Usually I'm on Twitter. I am going to be taking a short break for a couple of weeks this winter here. So I will be on and off the Twitter. I'm on the Instagram as well. It's always at Julia Aaron 80. And then Facebook is, I very rarely go to Facebook, but feel free if you friend me on Facebook, I'll probably go on. And then 3 months later, I'll accept all friend requests. And then I won't go on for another 3 months. So that's kind of my Facebook activity, but you're welcome to, you know, to find information there. And then I always, you know, I don't have a published book, and there's a reason for that. There's several reasons for that, actually, but I do have a blog that documents some really important learning that I did from my students during a certain period in my teaching career and in my life. It's julietetorres.blog. So if you want to read a little bit more about the work that I have done or am doing, then you can always do that there.
That is really good. Okay, well, thank you so much again for chatting with me. This has been really good, and I hope our listeners have gotten a lot out of our conversation. So thank you and happy teaching.
Thank you so much. You have a great one. Thank you.